Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this week. Coming up a little later in the hour, you'll want to stay tuned. Former Iowa resident John Little tells us what it's like to share an island with an active volcano, Kilauea. We've been hearing about that a lot in our news. Before that, the big news this week in the primary race for the Democratic nomination to face Republican Kim Reynolds, the exit of State Senator Nate Bolton. His departure comes less than 2 weeks before the June 5th primary, the Democratic primary for governor. Five other Democrats still contenders. Let's check in with IPR reporter and Morning Edition host Clay Masters. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
So let's talk about Bolton. Big surprise yesterday. What happened?
Well, he dropped out of the race, and this from the beginning has been a race from a lot of relatively unknown candidates for the Democratic nomination to square off against Governor Kim Reynolds in the fall. Nate Bolton, a labor attorney, he made a big splash at the State House when Democrats became the minority party. He was kind of the lead voice of dissent during that bill that was rolling back collective bargaining rights for public sector workers that was signed into law. And on Wednesday, the Des Moines Register detailed allegations of inappropriate sexual behavior. Three women had come forward, and some of these were from more than a decade ago. Bolton on Wednesday put out a statement saying, regardless of the difference in my memory or the context of the situation, it is not my place to disqualify what these women felt. And Bolton also mentioned in this that these were in social settings, not at the Capitol or in a workplace. And yesterday, he and his wife were on Des Moines TV station KCCI, and the anchor there asked him for just some clarification in this distinction. And here's what he had to say.
If there is a positive to come out about this, it is for a broader and better discussion of social boundaries and roles and what they mean. We have a very clear, bright line in workplace situations and in power imbalance situations. This is a different area, and I'm not trying to minimize anything anybody has said. I can't say that enough. But this is a different conversation than has been developing in a lot of respects, and hopefully the positive thing that comes out of this is that it becomes a teachable moment on the social interaction and for a lot of people.
And now it's between five candidates for that nomination.
Okay, so talk about how Nate Bolton's exit, because he was one of the not the at the front, but he was polling well, right?
He was polling well, and it definitely changes the dynamic of this race. As I mentioned earlier, it's a field of largely unknown candidates. The two other so-called front runners, if you will, are Fred Hubbell and Kathy Glosson. Hubbell is a retired Des Moines businessman who has spent a lot of money on this race. He's put a couple $1 million of his own money into his own campaign. His main opponent has been Senator Bolton. The Iowa poll, which came out feels like weeks ago, but it was just last weekend, it showed Hubbell with an 11 percentage point lead. Bolton was at 20. Glosson, who's a nurse and a union leader and who is running pretty far to the left, calling herself a bold progressive, she was at 13%. And so Hubbell was below 35%. And here's that reminder. If a candidate does not get 35% of the vote, it goes to a special nominating committee where then activists would decide the nominee. And I'm seeing some Glosson supporters saying that could give her an advantage, but I could really see this thing tipping in Hubbell's favor to win outright on that June 5th primary.
Mm-hmm. There have been a couple of debates. I think one more to go, Clay. What have you gleaned from those back and forths?
The final debate is on May 30th. That's broadcast on KCCI television, and it's co-sponsored by the Des Moines Register. The first forum, it was a debate, but the candidates really didn't interact much. It didn't give you much of a window into seeing how the candidates compared to one another. The second debate with the six candidates, there was more back and forth. There was a lot of piling up against Fred Hubbell, who is seen by many, by most people and analysts as the front runner. And it's going to really be interesting to see on the 30th how this now plays out in just a five-person race.
What issues are emerging as perhaps decisive in the Democratic primary?
Well, healthcare has been front and center. You look back in 2016, former Governor Terry Branstad made a move to privatize Medicaid, and that was handed over to three for-profit companies. There has been some problems with that. Even Governor Kim Reynolds has expressed concerns about the way that this rolled out. Medicaid has been a big thing, a big topic among the different candidates as I've interviewed them. There's also been a lot of talk about having enough money for mental health. This is something that I know you've talked about on River to River over the last few months, having enough beds. And really just healthcare has been front and center here. And another thing that seems to be, well, it's something that I've been trying to press a lot of these candidates about is just how they connect to rural voters, because election after election, we've seen when candidates only play up the urban vote, they come up short if they're falling behind in the urban vote, in the rural vote.
Mm-hmm. Do you see ways in which these candidates are attempting to connect with rural voters?
Well, a lot of them are kind of just staying with this message that all of these issues, mental health, health care, all of these different health care issues go across, you know, it doesn't matter where somebody lives. And so they're trying to speak of a message of unity more so than, you know, what divides urban and rural voters. And, you know, you look at, I did some digging here just to look at the past elections, just to refresh myself. You look back over the past decade and just how Democrats and Republicans have done. In 2008, Barack Obama did well in many rural counties, not as many in 2012. In 2010, former Governor Terry Branstad knocked off Democrat Chet Culver in that governor's race. And in 2014, gubernatorial candidate Jack Hatch, who was a senator from Des Moines, only won one county, Johnson County. And the Senate election in 2014, Democrat Bruce Braley ran up some of the urban counties, but didn't do so hot in a lot of the rural counties against now U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. Mm-hmm. So I think that there really needs to be, in the general election, when you pivot to that, whoever's going to run against Republican Governor Kim Reynolds is going to need to be able to speak to Iowans no matter where they live.
Right. And specifically to that, I wonder if any of their pitches are tailored specifically to beating Kim Reynolds.
Yeah, and Fred Hubbell and Kathy Glosson, certainly the two what are still perceived as the front runners in this race, in the interviews that have aired during Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as well as during River to River, Glosson and Hubbell have both gone after Kim Reynolds, and they've also, if you look at the other candidates who are left in Andy McGuire, the former Iowa Democratic Party chair. You look at Ross Wilburn, the former Iowa City mayor, and John Norris, who's been involved in Democratic politics, working for Tom Harkin and Tom Vilsack. All of them are going after Kim Reynolds. They're talking a lot about just what her policies, as they see, have been detrimental to Iowans across the state, regardless of where they live. And, you know, at the same time, Kim Reynolds, you know, she's unopposed in the Republican Party. And reminder here, she was never elected governor. She was a lieutenant governor and took over when Governor Terry Branstad went to China to become the U.S. ambassador there for the Trump administration. She's been running ads. You've probably been seeing them if you're watching TV, kind of introducing herself and talking about being a busy mom and finishing her college back in 2016. You know, she's from St. Charles, Iowa. And, you know, as I said, I think the Democrat, whoever it is, if they don't have a strong message in rural Iowa, it's going to be hard for them to win.
Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that Democrats are energized in this election cycle?
I certainly have seen a lot more energy from the Democrats in this election cycle since I've been here, as far as a midterm. You know, I was here in 2014, and I have seen a lot more people showing up to different forums, to multi-candidate events. There seems to be more enthusiasm. But, you know, voter turnout is down a lot during midterm elections.
Clay, before we say goodbye, a quick word to the Libertarians. There's a contest there as well, right?
Yeah, there's a contested primary between the two Libertarian candidates who are running for their nomination to run in the fall. We've talked to both of them for our series of conversations with candidates ahead of the election, and you can find those as well in our voter guide, Jake Porter and Marco Battaglia.
Okay. Polls are open for early voting. I'm wondering, to go back to the exit of Nate Bolton here, what about those early votes that have already been cast for Nate Bolton?
Yeah, a lot of people have already voted early, and the Secretary of State's office actually sent out a tweet following Bolton's suspension of his campaign for governor. They said, quote, "Since we're being asked this question, Iowa code does not allow voters to change their votes after their ballots have been cast." So, you know, if they've already voted for Bolton, that's who they voted for.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Thanks for the update, Clay.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Starting today and into the weekend, the University of Iowa rowing team is competing in the NCAA championships, and that's being held in Sarasota, Florida. In fact, already today, the first varsity eight and second varsity eight placed second in their respective heats and advanced to Saturday's, tomorrow's semifinals. Now, before the team headed south, I had a chance to talk with University of Iowa rowing head coach Andrew Carter.
Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you. That's it's very nice of you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is the Hawkeyes' second consecutive appearance at this championship and the third appearance in its history. What's going on? What's been the key to the recent success?
Well, I think we've had a really positive culture on our team, and I've been here now for 5 years, and we've been able to build every year, and it seems to be snowballing. The women are fantastic. They're not afraid of anything, and they're really excited about the progress that they seem to be able to measure every day, and it really provides great momentum for the program.
Mm-hmm. So remind us, because this is not a sport most of us practice or perhaps not very familiar with, give us the basics of this sport. How many women in the boat, and what are their roles?
Well, we have a variety of boat classes to start with. We row in both coxed fours and coxed eights. So the eights have eight rowers on board plus one coxswain, and she's the steers person and strategist and all of those types of things. And then the four will have four rowers plus a coxswain. And then we have multiple divisions. We have our first varsity eight, our second varsity eight, our first varsity four, second varsity four, etc. And right down into what we refer to as our talent transfer division, or traditionally referred to as a novice division, which is athletes from other sports transferring into rowing once they get to the collegiate level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you're out there competing, you're competing with at once with how many other boats?
Well, it can range. During the regular season, we'll have a variety of types of regattas. Some of them are match races where we're matched up with one other program. For example, we have a Big Ten double dual regatta every year where in the morning we'll race one Big Ten school in all the different boat classes, and in the afternoon we'll race a different Big Ten school. And then sometimes there are larger regattas where we'll have six lanes across, and a variety of programs will be represented in the various boat classes, and it's a little bit more like a track meet.
Mm-hmm. So you said at the start, and it really piqued my interest, that the key to your success, one of the keys, is that your women are not afraid of anything. What is there to be afraid of in rowing?
Yeah. Well, it's really the training and the racing experience. I mean, for anybody who's cracked a physiology or a physiology of exercise book will recognize that physiologists acknowledge that rowing is the most demanding physical sporting activity that there is. It's quite a difficult thing to put your body through a racing scenario. And then our preparations for that in training certainly mimic a lot of that, and it can be pretty daunting. The volume and the intensity. Rowing in particular is the only sport in the world that can be defined as a power endurance sport. So not only do they have to be able to generate very high forces, but they have to be able to sustain that. You know, a football down lineman is more of a power sport where he produces a high force, but it's over very quickly. Or a marathon runner would be the other end of the spectrum. Not a lot of force, but a sustainable aerobic effort. We have to be able to do both. So our training is very complex. Our racing is very demanding. So it can be something that people will get a little bit nervous about when it comes to the days that we need to measure them.
Mm-hmm. Most of us can picture what a top, well, football player looks like, top basketball player, you know, the linebacker, you referenced football, or a swimmer, a Katie Ledecky or Michael Phelps with his V-shaped torso, his huge hands and feet. What does a gifted rower look like physically?
Yeah, it's some sort of cross between, you know, a Michael Phelps type of, you know, long, lanky volleyball player, basketball player. certainly, you know, high, like height, stature, long limbs, basically long levers, because when you think about a rower and how she interacts with the boat, it's just you know, some simple physics and a lot of levers. So the longer the levers, the more levers she can produce, and for the force she applies, she gets more torque. So, but a little bit different, I think, than you'll find with a volleyball player, because these women need to be able to generate these high forces. So there's a little bit more muscle on their frame, and really quite powerful.
Mm-hmm. What about the mental side of it? What does a top rower need mentally?
Well, they need to really like training. They really need to like working out, because we do a lot of it. We certainly push right up against our allowable limits from the NCAA in terms of our training hours per week. I know that that our women are out doing other things above and beyond what our practices are doing, because they're constantly asking me, is it okay if I do this, but will it interfere with the training program? So you have to be psychologically really keen on exercise and exercising hard. And then when it comes to racing, you have to be really tough. As I said, it's a really demanding physical exercise. So when they get into a racing situation, not only do they stress physically and need to be able to manage that, then you have all the stressors of being in competition and not only performing for yourself, but because you are so integral to the machine or to the crew as a whole, there's the added stress of, I absolutely can't let up for an instant, because everyone else in this boat is counting on me.
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked yet about specific women on this potentially the championship racing team. Tell us about some of the standouts.
Well, we have Contessa Harold was just named a day or two ago as the co-Big Ten Athlete of the Year for the sport of rowing. She's certainly a standout. She's a sophomore, came to us without any rowing experience at all, which the vast majority of our roster has come through our novice or talent transfer pathway. She's a South Dakota volleyball track type of athlete, so very athletically gifted. We also have Hunter Koningsfeld, who's actually Cedar Rapids native. She actually came to the University of Iowa as a track and cross-country runner, but for a variety of reasons couldn't continue. She has sustained some injuries and so on in that sport that running wasn't her thing anymore. So she's transferred into rowing. She's in her first year of rowing this year as a sophomore student, and she's sitting in our top crew already. Unbelievably gifted. Izzy Dolva, Ashley Duda, and Kaylin Heiberg are seniors sitting in our top crew that have developed over 4 years here and also came to us with little to no experience. The stroke woman in our first date, Eve Stewart, we recruited out of Amsterdam, and looks like a very good bet to be selected to the Dutch under 23 national team this summer. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for that. So we have a lot of women on this squad who have done amazing things in the last 2 to 4 years.
Okay, Andrew Carter, as head coach of the rowing team at the University of Iowa, during a race, what are you doing? Because you can't be right there with them, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we're very fortunate at the venue for this year. Nathan Benderson Park in Sarasota, Florida, actually is coming hot off of hosting the World Championship this past September. So it's one of the best venues in the world. And what it enables me to do is ride along the races with my bike. And I can watch it from start to finish. And that helps me alleviate some of the stress of not being able to be involved. Rowing is unique in that coaches are not allowed to be involved in the competitive process. If we get caught providing any sort of instruction or anything during the race, they'll be disqualified on the spot. So we really just have to sit back and watch.
So let me picture this. You are riding on a bike path next to the body of water they're racing in?
Yep. And, you know, I'll be monitoring some things. I'll have a little stroke watch there and be able to record some things and otherwise just try not to fall over.
Well, I hope you're monitoring on what's on the path in front of you.
Yeah, and I have seen people take a bit of a spill on these occasions. So, and it's a bit of a peloton, so all the coaches are doing the same thing.
tell me, you know, the women practice in the Iowa River here. Any other area places they practice, a lake, Lake McBride or anything?
Yeah, we do. Once in a while, we'll go to Lake McBride. The nice thing about Lake McBride is it's a still water body of water rather than something with current, which is what we'll race on. They never want us racing in championship racing on moving water because that obviously presents some unfair conditions. So we'll go to Lake McBride once in a while, and the Park Service out there has been really great about about providing us access, because that's actually our home racing venue, Lake McBride. So when we host events here, we're out at the park, and it's a great body of water, and we get great support from the DNR and all the folks there that govern that park.
Mm-hmm. This taking place, the championship taking place in Sarasota, Florida, of course, no frozen bodies of water there ever, but are we disadvantaged, the Hawkeyes disadvantaged over women in universities in warmer climes because we have, you know, frozen rivers and lakes a good part of the year?
Yeah, I think, you know, a little bit, but the University of Iowa, our athletic department, Gary Barta, our athletic director, oversaw the construction of the P. Sue Beckwith MD Boathouse, which is one of the best facilities in the world, that opened in 2009. And in that facility, they built in a 16-station powered rowing tank. So it simulates rowing on the water in addition to having our typical rowing machines, or rowing ergometers, we call them. So we can get as close to rowing in a boat as possible in one of the best facilities in the world. So we do definitely have a little bit of disadvantage against those southern crews, those California crews, but I think the work we put in and the facilities that we've been provided really help us to overcome that.
Okay. So some may be wondering, you know, this is a women's team, only women's team, but there is no varsity men's team. Explain why that is.
Well, there was a real explosion in women's rowing in particular through the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s. And as schools were working hard to provide more opportunities for female athletes, you know, in support of Title IX legislation, rowing seemed to be a sport that attracted athletic administrators and university administrators. It provides a lot of opportunity. It is a late entry sport, so athletes from a variety of sports can come to rowing and have successful careers, even going on to our national team. The majority of our national team has been developed through collegiate novice programs from athletes coming from other sports. So it seemed to be a really good fit as women's athletic opportunities expanded across the United States. And in the wake of that, men's rowing teams were not adopted for gender equity reasons to because the real focus was on expanding women's opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Andrew Carter, we sure appreciate you taking the University of Iowa rowing team to new heights. The University of Iowa rowing team competing in the NCAA championships, Sarasota, Florida, May 25th through the 27th. It's the second consecutive appearance by the women at this championship, the third appearance in the history of the University of Iowa rowing team. Andrew Carter will be thinking of you and the women and cheering you on from afar.
My pleasure.
After a short break, former Iowa resident John Little, who now calls Hawaii home, tells us what it's like to share the island with an active volcano, Kilauea.
It's Pahoehoe lava, smooth, flowing, and it's 2,000 degrees, but you could walk right up to it.
Also, Iowa State University research addresses the challenge of overcrowded and expanding cemeteries. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's take you halfway around the world to that volcanic eruption in Hawaii. Hawaii County has ordered about 2,000 people to evacuate since that eruption began on May 3rd. The volcano has opened up more than 20 vents in the ground, and these are vents not only spewing, releasing lava, but also sulfur dioxide and steam. And the lava has been pouring down the side of the volcano into the ocean miles away. It's an eruption that has destroyed 50 buildings, including a couple dozen homes. One person, we heard in our news just the other day, seriously injured after being hit by a flying piece of lava. Well, John Little and his wife Sue were Iowa residents until just a few years ago when they moved to Hawaii. Yes, the big island of Hawaii. John Little joins me now. Hi, John.
Aloha, Ben.
Aloha. Start off by giving us landlubbers here a little geography, a picture of where you are on the big island and where that active volcano is.
I'm glad to. think of the Big Island of Hawaii is approximately 7 times the size of Johnson County, Iowa. So 7 Johnson counties in size, has about 200,000 permanent residents, and it consists of 5 volcanoes. That's one of the confusing things, I think, to people, is that they don't realize there are different volcanoes, some of which are, for all practical purposes, extinct, as opposed to Kilauea, the volcano that's getting all the attention right now because of these dramatic eruptions. And but that volcano has been erupting since 1983 continuously, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. This is a big dramatic change that happens every now and then.
But since you've lived there, and you and Sue have been there since when?
We moved here 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, since you've been there, certainly it's the most active that volcano, Kilauea, has been. Explain a little bit more. I know you're not a volcanologist, but I know you inform yourself about the island and the different lava zones. Explain what's going on beneath your island.
I'll try to briefly. The island is divided up by the geologist into 9 different lava zones representing the different risk. Lava zone 9 has no risk. The last time there was live lava there was more than 60,000 years ago, as opposed to lava zone 1, which is high risk, where there's been lava continuously, or there a high likelihood of it, or high possibility of it. So there are these different lava zones. Mm-hmm. Where the current eruption is taking place is entirely in a lava zone 1, and it's on a different volcano than the one we live on. It's on the far eastern side of the island. It's a terrible, devastating thing for the people that are losing their homes, but in fact it's a very tiny part of the island that's being affected by this.
So it sounds like when you describe these lava zones and the risk in each zone that you're, you could liken it to flood zones. For instance, did these people who have lost their homes, it is a horrible thing, the buildings, they knew that they were in pretty great danger?
Yes, they did. Lava zone 1, Leilani Estates, it is devastating for the people losing their homes, losing their land, but they knew this is why this land was the cheapest land in Hawaii. And I say Leilani Estates, people that have several acres in Hawaii, and some of them are losing their homes, and people think, oh, rich people whose vacation homes will be covered by insurance. No, this is where working people live that don't have much money, and insurance is usually not even available there because it's lava zone 1. So many of these people are losing their homes and their land, and there is no insurance for most of them.
At the current time, what other great concerns do the residents of the island of Hawaii have right now because of this volcanic eruption?
Well, overall, the biggest concern on the island is, I think, the drop-off in the visitor reservations for the coming summer and that sort of thing. They're always, of course, concerned about that. People in the small area affected by it, of course, have no idea. Their home might not be consumed by lava, but it might be so close that they may not be able to get back to it again. Mm-hmm. This is entirely possible. There are approximately 400 electrical points, billing points, 400 homes roughly that have had the electricity turned off because they are in permanent serious danger.
So you talk about the people's concerns being mostly tourist concerns. Aren't there any sort of real doomsayers? Anybody worried that you've talked to, that you hear about, that the whole thing will go up like a Mount Vesuvius, sort of a Pompeii type of thing, or the Indonesian island of Krakatoa in the 1880s?
Thank you, Ben, for mentioning this. No, this is, as the volcanologists call it, a shield volcano, not a strata volcano. Krakatoa, Vesuvius, Mount St. Helens, those are all stratovolcanoes, what we think of as this tall mountain that blows its top. Kilauea is what's called a shield volcano. Imagine a shield, lay it on the ground. It's a long,
big dome. Think of it that way. The caldera, where the active lava lake has been forever, it seems, that's more than 25 miles away from where the lava is actually coming out of the ground today. Because that's what they mean when they say it's coming out of a rift in the a rift way out on that shield. Think of that shield laying on the ground, and way out on the corner of that shield near the ocean is where the lava is emerging.
Mm. I'm going to retract my statement that you're not a volcanologist based on that answer.
You want to pay attention to this here. Here's a historical incident. Do you know that General George S. Patton, when he was in Hawaii prior to World War II, attempted to stop a lava flow by bombing it from the air?
This is historical truth.
Historical truth.
And the outcome of that, did you research that?
It didn't work.
Somehow I didn't think George Patton would have success against a lava flow. Have you been close to a lava flow? How close?
We did, about a year and a half ago. Sue and I went down and made the trek into where lava was actively flowing. It's Pahoehoe lava, so that means it's smooth, flowing. I mean, it's 2,000 degrees, but you could walk right up to it. You could literally stand on top of the freshly cooled lava and look at a crack in the lava, and 18 inches down is red hot lava, and you could walk around and look at it. Mm. And it was slowly flowing into the ocean. We've also taken the ocean, the boat tours that at least a year ago could take you right up to the lava flowing into the ocean. And I mean a few feet away from it as it flows into the ocean. Today, it's larger, more dangerous. Those kinds of tourist things aren't available as easily today. But yes, we've been right up to the lava.
So, John, you mentioned you and your wife, Sue, have been living there, transplants from Iowa to Hawaii, the Big Island, 2.5 years ago. You must be missing Iowa winters.
Ben, as I'm sure you know, we have many microclimates here. The one that our home is located in, the temperature varies between 60 and 80 year-round.
60 and 80 degrees, it's right within that the whole time?
The whole time.
So you don't need a heater?
We don't have a heater. We don't have air conditioners. Three-quarters of the windows in our home stay open 9 months of the year.
Amazing.
It is.
John
paradise.
Little, thanks for giving us a little picture from you and Sue's paradise there. John Little transplants from Iowa with his wife, Sue. They've lived on the Big Island for 2.5 years, giving us a picture of what's been happening there with the volcanic eruption. John, you take care. Thanks for letting Iowans know how it is there.
Oh, you're very welcome, Ben. Thank you. And as we say here, ahui ho. Until next time.
Aloha. Ahui ho.
Ahui ho.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Human population of our planet is closing in on 8 billion. That's roughly double the Earth's population from when I was born in the 1960s. More and more people means more overcrowded cities for the living, but also potential overcrowding for the dead. No, this is not a zombie apocalypse story. Some cemeteries also here in Iowa, are running out of room. My next guest is one of the few researchers in the U.S. who has been studying and publishing research on the land use implications of cemeteries and burial. Carlton Basmajian is an associate professor in the community and regional planning at Iowa State University. Carlton, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I understand this spring your students took on the problem of overcrowded cemeteries, and the class was called City of the Dead. Good title.
Yeah.
What problem did you tackle?
So we were working with the city of Perry, Iowa, in the far northwest corner of Dallas County, and it was a request by the city manager, in fact, who's an alum of our program, to look at the cemetery, the city's public cemetery. They're essentially on a relatively short timeline in terms of running out of space. The projections are 5 to 10 years, depending on, you know, how things shake out exactly. And in the meantime, the city has acquired a additional parcel, a 17-acre parcel that's directly adjacent to the old city cemetery, which is currently farmland. And they contacted us about looking at some options for how that land might be developed. And so we put together a small class of undergraduate students in the College of Design who were tasked with coming up with some ideas, some policies, looking at finances, how this land might be developed over time, and what a future development might, for a future cemetery, might actually look like.
Mm-hmm. And the options that they explored and the problem that they explored that's exhibited there in Perry is not, Perry's not the only one to have this problem. This is something across the U.S. because what? Communities, they don't do a very good job of planning cemeteries, or historically speaking.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So this is something we have looked at over time. I've been working on this with a co-author for a number of years, and basically what we've learned is that very few communities do much active planning for cemeteries or human burial. And this goes back, as far as we can tell, at least to World War II, if not earlier. And as a result, particularly in large metros where you've got a lot of population pressure and really high land values, developing cemeteries, new cemeteries, is really difficult. It's controversial in many ways. And many older cemeteries can't be expanded because they've been basically hemmed in by new development, residential, commercial, whatever it may be. And so some of them are kind of caught in a little bit of a conundrum. It varies from city to city. I was frankly surprised to see it in Perry, but luckily Perry Cemetery is still on the edge of Perry, so there was space to move.
Right.
But the bigger issue, yes, is there are cities around the country now that are starting to face this, and as a result, the prices of burial have gone up in a lot of larger metros because of the increasing scarcity of those kind of, and I hate to say this, but prime burial sites within those, within particularly older cemeteries within those regions.
Mm-hmm. So your class, I think about a dozen students you had here, City of the Dead, what were the solutions they came up with for Perry in this case?
Well, I divided them into teams, and so they, each little group kind of went on their own path to come up with some ideas. But generally speaking, we looked at what the projection for the amount of space that Perry is going to need going forward, given its demographics and death and current prevailing death rates. They also looked at how disposition is changing. So we're getting a relatively rapid rise in cremation rates in the U.S. And the disposition, interment of cremains really is different than a full body burial. So they looked at what a cremation burial would look like. So they designed in some ideas for columbaria and as well as in-ground cremains burials. They looked at creating a more recreational park-like atmosphere for the cemetery where it might become used for more than just burial, but would become a place that people in Perry might go to relax. They also, in most of the projects, actually looked at preserving or restoring some of that land and not using it for burial at all, but perhaps turning it back into kind of a natural ecosystem of some sort that would be permanent as, a way to restore a little bit of green space. It's not used for farming and not cultivated, doesn't have pesticides applied to it or a lawnmower run over it, that it could just be kind of preserved. So In all, they kind of found that Perry's got way more space than it needs for the next 50 years.
Right.
And so their designs kind of reflected that changing nature of need.
Mm-hmm. And your area of study here, Carlton, will really be on the upswing. We have the baby boomers are aging and will eventually pass from this life, and will be deciding how they will be interred, right?
Absolutely. There's almost 80 million baby boomers, and how they age into the next phase is a huge question. And we have been working on this, hoping that cities, planners around the country will start to pay attention and start planning for some of this, you know, what we're going to do with all these people when they're, I mean, I hate to say this again, but what we're going to do with all these people when they're no longer alive, and right, where we're going to put them.
Right. And in going back to what you referenced a little bit earlier, it's a little bit about like changing ideas of what a cemetery might be, public perceptions, yeah, of cemeteries. That is something you say needs to change, or we would benefit from changing.
Well, yeah, and we're seeing, so, you know, historically cemeteries were much more multi-use spaces way back in the 19th century, when the first kind of real explicitly designed cemeteries in the U.S. were put together. They were used for recreational purposes. It was quite common. They really predate urban parks in many respects, and they're kind of like the precursors in a sense. That changed in the 20th century. They became much more single-use spaces, and a lot of communities started to really discourage people from going to cemeteries except for when there was a service or a burial. The swing back now is, how do we, because every city has them, how do we use them for something else? And so we're starting to see some cities take a much more active role in reconceiving the cemetery as a multi-purpose green space. Yeah. But that's not taken everywhere.
Right, right. I used to live, as a young man, used to live next to a cemetery in my college days, and I actually loved it for that very reason. It was a quiet, mm-hmm, space to go, to walk around, you know, sit down or whatever, and get away from the sounds of traffic and the hustle and bustle, right?
Yep. That's exactly right, and that's the purpose they served. And so we're hoping to kind of urge people, to communities, to move back in that direction, to see them for that purpose. And that was one of the, I guess, kind of the big strategies the students were working with in Perry was, well, what can we do to get people to see it this way in the community and actually want to go there and be comfortable with the public investment in this infrastructure to make it beautiful?
Mm-hmm. Carlton Basmajian, Associate Professor in Community and Regional Planning at Iowa State University, this spring taught a course, City of the Dead, taking on the problem of overcrowded cemeteries in that new class. I have to ask you, before we say goodbye, Carlton, this must have generated some discussion about among your students about what they want to have happen to their bodies.
It was interesting. We did talk about that, and most of them seem to be most interested in natural burial, sort of the unembalmed, put me in a pine box in a field and plant the tree on top of me kind of camp. And I don't know if this is generational or not, but it was really interesting to hear them say that.
Carlton, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your research.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Well, that does it for this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. All that's left to do is to ease into the weekend. Mark Simmet, Studio One Tracks host, is joining me now. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you. I always say some version of this at the end of the week, but our news weeks are so fast and furious. I do need a long, tall glass of groove into the weekend. What do you have for us?
Okay, well, I've got an artist by the name of Ry Cooter, who's been around for over a career of over 50 years now, believe it or not, as a guitarist and songwriter, drawing inspiration from American roots music, but probably still best known to many as the producer of the Buena Vista Social Club album, and then later on that was a documentary film featuring Cuban musicians that came out about 20 years ago. So Ry Cooter has had a long, illustrious career, and he has a new album out. It's called Prodigal Son, and I wanted to play a track for you called Shrinking Man.
Okay, Shrinking Man. Thanks, Mark, Studio One Tracks host. Ry Cooter, Shrinking Man, to take us grooving into the weekend. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure.
You look as good as you can, but
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Also, Big shout out to Ben Stanton. Sadly, we say goodbye to him as producer on our talk shows very soon. He and his family moving to Kansas, and there's one very, very small silver lining. I won't have to share my name with another Ben on the IPR staff, but there are far more downsides. We will miss you, Ben Stanton, for all your great work, which all IPR listeners have enjoyed. But not only that, I want to thank you for your friendship. You will be missed. Thank you, Ben Stanton. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining.
Sometimes I worry about food, 'cause a thinking man's gotta eat right sometime. I don't need much and I don't pay no starvation wage to poor folks out on a poison ground.